And the end result over the course of those months was we signed up something like 25,000 volunteers and sent a total of more than 1 million letters.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Scott Forman is another political entrepreneur who's tried to tackle the turnout problem. He brought his background in direct mail and behavioral science from OPower and other places to the political arena. He is a founder of a nonprofit called Vote Forward. Vote Forward inspired more than 1 million handwritten letters to voters in 2018. Scott did everything needed to invent, test, deploy technology to support and market and find partnerships to get all those letters written and sent. So Scott is another good story of political entrepreneurship that made a measurable difference. And after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Scott Forman at Vote Forward.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is G-R-A-P-H-I-C-A-C-Y.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
So can I get you to introduce yourself and give me a quick biography?
It's funny. I haven't done this in a while. I grew up in LA, went to Harvard, graduated in 2004. I was sort of science geek in high school. And then in college, I got interested in social science. So I did this sort of interdisciplinary social science program at Harvard called Social Studies. People always laugh at the name. It sounds like middle school, but it's like a mix of economics and political science and sociology. And I did a bunch of English literature stuff too. Kind of a weird, eclectic academic program. After I graduated, I moved to New York and didn't really have any idea what I wanted to do for a living. I wound up working for a hedge fund for a couple of years, which was an illuminating and not particularly enjoyable experience, but it was useful because I learned a lot about software development while I was there. And then I sort of cut my professional teeth at a company called OPower, which is a software company that served utilities, electric and natural gas utilities, and used sort of nudge tactics, behavioral science-y stuff, to encourage people to reduce their energy consumption. That was a big success. We ran these really big direct mail programs where we would send people mail that would encourage them to use less energy and sort of do a bit of a social pressure tactic. We would compare people's energy usage to their neighbors, which turned out to be really effective. So I was there for, I guess, 6 years until shortly before there was an IPO. And worked on a bunch of different projects there as a software product manager, which is really what I do for a living. I left in, I guess, 2012, moved to New York, did a little freelance product stuff, traveled a bit, got married, moved to California, started my own startup with a colleague from OPower, which is sort of an online education play. It's an online coaching platform, mostly for creative people. So right now it's for creative writers, and we sort of pair aspiring writers with coaches to help them develop a long-term writing practice and not give up.
What's that called?
It's called One Room. The website is joinoneroom.com. And that's still going, although it's just me at this point. So it's sort of not entirely my main focus, largely because I sort of took a long sabbatical in 2017 after I got sick. I was diagnosed with a sarcoma in 2017, and so I spent a lot of time that year doing cancer treatment, which was not much fun, but it worked out okay in the end. And I'm sort of healthy now, I'm happy to say. And when I got back from that is when I really started working on political things, kind of decided that it was what mattered to me most. And so I started Vote Forward in late 2017. And I guess that's mainly what we'll talk about today.
Well, yeah, what is the founding story for Vote Forward?
It kind of started as a guerrilla experiment. The one thing that I feel like I really learned from my startup time is that you don't really need permission from anybody to try things. I had been nursing this hunch for a while that direct mail of a particular kind could be effective for voter turnout in the same way that we found at Opower that it was effective for energy efficiency. I did a bunch of research on that, discovered that there's actually a nonprofit that does a version of that that has proven to be extremely effective called the Voter Participation Center, which you're probably familiar with.
Yes, I interviewed the head of that.
So I think what they do is great. It's sort of almost directly parallel to what we did at Opower. It's a similar idea. And so I kind of decided, okay, well, they're already doing that. We don't really need somebody to do that again or another take on that. But I also had the suspicion that handwritten communications could make a big difference in direct mail. The idea being that just sort of looking at my own experience, if you get a letter in the mail and it has a handwritten address on the outside, I am much more likely to open that and take it seriously. And so I kind of thought maybe that was true for most people. I wrote a version of a sort of plea to a fellow citizen to vote and then customized it with some handwritten text. So it's kind of a mix of typed and handwritten. Not necessarily the most effective thing, but I kind of thought it was probably the best compromise between being fast to produce and effective. So it's a handwritten envelope with typewritten and handwritten letter on the inside. And I just kind of planned this randomized trial for the Alabama special election for the Senate in 2017 and did it. It went pretty quickly from a harebrained idea to an actual project where I was sort of sitting at my kitchen table writing lots of letters just to see if it would work. And that's kind of how it started.
How did it go there in that state?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the key thing is that it took a few months to find out because, you know, voter files take a long time to get updated. But I discovered in, I guess it was March or April of 2018, that it had worked incredibly well, like shockingly well. I sent 1,000 letters, and in the end, compared to the control group, we saw an increase in turnout of 3.9 percentage points. So control group turnout was, I think, 49-point-something%, and letter recipients were the almost 53% of them voted.
In that case, how did you select the 1,000 in the control group? Was that randomized?
So, I mean, what you do with any randomized trial like this is you sort of select a universe of people that you want to intervene with, and then you randomly assign them to either a control group or a treatment group. They're matched in the sense that there shouldn't be anything systematically different between them, but then you only intervene with some of them so that you can compare after the fact.
It's sort of amazing to me that you'd get almost 4% difference with all the things that are impinging upon a voter's life to have. Is that just one letter?
It's just one letter, yeah.
It seems like there must be a lot of people who are in a balancing situation between voting and not voting for that to be the case.
Yeah, I think so. I think there are people that can be tipped over into participating with these kinds of nudges. I mean, I think that's the lesson. That was a single trial with a sample size of 1,000. And so you can only sort of draw so much from a single test. So before really scaling it up to be much bigger, we did a second randomized trial in the Ohio 12 special in August 2018. Larger, simplified the letter a little bit, and tested the software platform that we also built to make it easy for other people to do this. and found there that it had a 1.4 percentage point effect, which for voter turnout is still, you know, really respectable. It's not quite as startlingly effective, but still plenty to make it worthwhile.
What do you think was the difference between those two? Do you think it was statistical anomaly or the election or the letter? Or
It's hard to say. It's probably some combination of all those things. The letter was different. So in Alabama, I included a pre-stamped reply postcard. I think maybe there's something about getting a piece of mail that also has a, and this seems like a small thing, but the fact that—
Did anyone write you back?
Very few people returned it. But the fact that there was a stamp in there, somebody took the trouble to buy a stamp and send it to you, I think maybe makes a difference. I'm not sure. The more important thing is that the targeting was pretty different. Maybe this is too much in the weeds, but in Ohio—
That's where I like to go.
Okay, weeds is good. Well, I'll keep going then. In Ohio, I had this idea about a different way to do the targeting, and I accidentally chose people who were, as a baseline, more likely to vote. So I think the control group in Ohio had a higher turnout.
They have these models of propensity to vote, and I suspect that if you pick people who are at 50%, then a letter is much more likely to show a lot of effect than if you pick someone further away from that.
I think there's some truth to that, but what I've been made to understand is that it's not quite as much as you would expect. That within a broad range of vote propensities, somewhere between maybe say 20 and 80, that most interventions have sort of the same percentage point impact.
That's why you can't guess at things. You have to actually look at data.
Yeah. I'm not totally sure about that. So, but from the Analyst Institute, that's kind of the impression I've gotten.
So you had background from your Opower job in doing this kind of trial and doing direct mail, but you also just mentioned that you are aware of, and it sounds like worked with Analyst Institute. How did you find them? And what was, as you entered this political area, which I think was mostly new to you, how did you like acquaint yourself with things like the Voter Participation Center and the Analyst Institute and so on, and who was helpful?
I'm trying to remember who it was who actually put me in touch with Aaron at the Analyst Institute. I think it might have been somebody at AFL-CIO who I had a connection to through a friend at Opower who has been active in politics.
Aaron Strauss we're talking about, probably.
Yes, Aaron. Yeah. You know, some through those kinds of connections. And then ultimately, kind of gradually, as I started to do more stuff, people would recommend other folks to talk to and kind of got more and more familiar with the players. I guess the other key thing is that once it seemed that the Alabama trial had worked, had a positive result, that made a big difference because then people were like, oh, maybe there's something really here. And then we're much more keen to talk, which is something I would recommend to anybody who's sort of interested in getting involved in this world or any world. Doing rigorous tests is a really great way to get started because once you have a good reason to believe that the thing that you're doing actually works, it makes it much easier to, you know, find people who are interested in helping and so on and so forth.
But the receptivity in the political space to rigorous testing and to being impressed by it is a recent revolution.
Yeah, I've gotten that impression. I mean, I'm new to it. And I'm sure I've been sort of lucky also a bit in the people that I've connected with. So Aaron Strauss and the Analyst Institute are fantastic, I think. They've been very helpful and supportive and have helped me get in touch with other people who are sort of similar spirit.
Subsequent to the Ohio 12 special, what was the story of Vote Forward going forward?
The purpose of the Ohio trial was just to get more confident that it is a real effect. And on the strength of that success, I kind of scrambled to scale it up for November. That was the goal, was to try to have a big impact on the midterms. with, again, help from Opower friends and other friends who are software people and design people, we kind of enhanced this software platform to try to make it possible to scale it up and have a lot more people participate in it. The website, by the way, is votefwd.org, voteforward.org. We got the website working in a way that would make it easy for volunteers to write letters. That's kind of the main thing that it does, is assign letters to volunteers. And then I just kind of plugged away at trying to get as many people as possible to sign up and start writing letters and stockpiling them. So the idea was to save them until just before the election and then send them. So starting over the summer, I spent a lot of time mostly just recruiting volunteers. And I'll tell you more about how that went.
Well, one thing that you hadn't made clear, but was sort of an assumption if you're working with Analyst Institute and the like, is was your purpose to get out any particular type of voter, i.e. one party or the other?
That's a very important detail. So in the early stage, I thought a little bit about whether I wanted to make this a nonpartisan effort, because I really do believe in voter turnout, period. Like, I think more participation is good. But I also am a Democrat, and I want my team to win, especially right now. And so I decided to make it sort of an explicitly partisan project. So the mission is to elect Democrats. And what that means is that the potential voters that we targeted are people who are unlikely to vote, but if they do vote, are very likely to vote for the Democratic candidate.
Can you give me a sense of the scale of the letters that you stockpiled and were sent in the midterm?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is what wound up amazing me. It got very popular. There were a couple of points in the promotional side trying to gain attention for it that were pivotal. So there were these two other projects, Crush the Midterms and Multiply Your Vote, which was the thing that Julia Louis-Dreyfus was behind. They wound up recommending Vote Forward as their sort of suggested activity for introverts, which turns out to be a really persuasive thing for a lot of people. There are a lot of people who don't really want to make phone calls or knock on doors, and this is a good alternative for them. So that helped a ton. And then the most important thing, and I can't thank them enough, is that some folks at Daily Kos wound up being really enthusiastic about it and promoted it to their mailing list. And the end result over the course of those months was we signed up something like 25,000 volunteers and sent a total of more than 1 million letters, which I can't even wrap my mind around how that happened. But yeah, so in the end, it was, I think, 1.2 million letters to 56 different congressional districts.
If you do the math on that and you're, say, picking up 1.4% of the extra voters,
it comes out to 10,000 extra votes,
which is a large number for you to have personally affected, and but also a pretty small number compared to 25,000 volunteers. It kind of underlines how this game of politics is fought on the margins, you know?
I think that's a really good point. The truth is, it's hard. I mean, this is sort of the opposite of what you suggested earlier with respect to the Alabama trial. But the truth is, it's hard to get people to do stuff. I mean, even 3-point-something percentage points.
Especially with just a letter, right? I mean, obviously there are things that would be illegal, but like if you said, here's $20 if you vote, or, you know, like what would be the, I assume that you've, like you and vote.org and all these other places that are trying to enhance turnout are racking your brains for things that will turn a non-voter into a voter. It's friends texting and all kinds of, you know, billboards. And
yes, the truth is there are lots and lots of things that have been tried. I would commend the Analyst Institute to anybody who's curious about reading all of them. My understanding is that the social pressure mail that Voter Participation Center does, my project, these handwritten letters, and then in the last weekend, canvassing, or the last couple of weekends, canvassing, knocking on doors, are the most effective things. But they're still only, as you said, they're only really effective at the margin. Like, does take a lot of work to get one extra person to vote. Now, the thing I really liked about the Julia Louis-Dreyfus project is the name of it, the multiply your vote idea. Because if you think about it with that frame, if you can send, you know, 30 letters, it takes you maybe an hour, and cause one extra person to vote in a battleground state where that vote sometimes makes the difference between, you know, winning and losing, that's pretty compelling to have that kind of impact.
Did you run across the guy doing vote tripling?
No, I don't think so.
There are a whole lot of people with behavioral science ideas about getting more people to vote. And I'm glad they're all out there. And then Jess Regal with Motivote, who mentioned you to me, is another example. Like, you've had some experience in entrepreneurship. What did you learn about political entrepreneurship with this foray into this space?
I guess this doesn't really say much about politics. It says more about me. But I did have my prior suspicion confirmed that you should always do randomized trials if you can, and that you should just do them, and that you don't really need permission from anybody to try something. My inclination in this world is that it's always worth doing small, fast experiments first to figure out whether something works before you invest a lot of time and energy in it and try to scale it up. One lesson from this experience is that that does seem to apply in politics too, not surprisingly. That's one learning. The other is that once you have something that you have reason to believe is effective, it does require a fair amount of persistence to gain any attention or traction. So the recruiting of volunteers was very slow for the first 6 weeks of, you know, contacting everybody I could think of to try to encourage them to share it with their audience. And then, you know, only after that sort of pavement pounding groundwork had been laid, by luck and sending the right thing to the right person at the right time, did I wind up forming these partnerships that really made the difference in acquiring volunteers. So I guess those are sort of two opposite messages. One is be scrappy and be willing to abandon your idea quickly if it doesn't actually work. And then the other is, if it does work, it does take a lot of persistence to gain anybody's attention in the world we live in.
Be stubborn but flexible.
Yep, I think that's a good way to put it.
Were there other online applications or efforts to get people to write letters by hand like this?
Not letters that I'm aware of. There is a project called Postcards to Voters. I don't actually know a lot about them.
I had some friends that were, you know, went to parties and wrote, and I don't know if it was letters or postcards, but, you know, I was curious if it was you they were working with or somebody else.
It could have been either. We did have parties happen all over the country, and Daily Coast was helpful in sort of helping to organize those too. So it might have been Vote Forward, or it might have been Postcards. I'm not sure.
Do you feel highly competitive to Postcards to Voters or Boxes to Voters or any of the other?
No, not really. it turns out that the people, I we're sort of, the people who are inclined to do one are also inclined to do the others. And so we're kind of like talking to the same groups of volunteers. But I don't feel competitive with them. I'm glad that project exists. I think they're doing great work and have sort of laid a lot of good groundwork here. So I don't think they need to be competitive, especially because they're sort of a different ethos a little bit. Like, if you look at the postcards that people write, they're often very creative. People draw on them and so on and so forth. I think it's sort of in some ways more appealing to a craftier audience. And what I offered was more appealing to a sort of epistolary audience or a sort of language oriented. I don't know. That's the spurious distinction. I don't know what I'm trying to say. The point is they peacefully coexist, and I'm glad that Postcards exists too.
A question I've asked a number of the good folks like you in the turnout game is, does it make sense to have all these separate organizations doing separate things, or would it make sense to combine them into multiple projects of a bigger turnout operation? What's your thought on that?
I think it may make sense to coordinate more, but there's a trade-off. I mean, the advantage of having lots of different people doing different things is that it means that there's a lot of flexibility and ferment. The fact that there are lots of people independently trying out different ideas, I think, is really valuable. At the same time, there is something that is lost by not coordinating. I'm not sure. I don't really have a strong opinion about that. Running big organizations is hard, and it's very hard to keep them flexible as they grow. So it's easy to imagine that coordination is good in the abstract. But if you try to then construct the entity that would fruitfully coordinate all of these different activities, it's harder in practice. That's not a firm answer one way or the other, just to say I think it's complicated.
What are your personal plans going forward? So it sounds like it was a pretty energizing experience and pretty successful. And are you going to continue into 2020? What's going to change? Where are you?
I loved working on this. I mean, it was a ton of fun. And I'm really glad that it was also effective and an outlet for the energy of a lot of volunteers. So I'm going to keep working on it. I'm planning in 2019 to conduct some more experiments to try to refine it. I'm not convinced that the version we have right now is the perfect version. So I think there's a lot of incremental improvements that are possible. And there are important elections happening in 2019, statewide elections in I think, 4 or 5 states in November. And then there will probably be some congressional special elections after various congresspeople are indicted or resigned or go to prison. We're definitely going to keep running relatively small campaigns in 2019, and then, but all with an eye towards doing something even bigger in 2020. There is a question mark around 2020, which is that the busier and louder the election, the less effective any given intervention can be, because baseline turnout among registered voters is actually pretty high in a presidential election. Doesn't mean there aren't people who are worth targeting, and it may be that there are plenty. I haven't quite done all of the math there yet. But the other thing I'm exploring is whether there's a way to use this kind of tactic to encourage voter registration also, because I think there's a pretty good argument that the most important thing heading into 2020 is to register a lot of new voters. This is early stages. I'm still thinking through how this is going to work, but I definitely want to try handwritten letters to encourage not yet registered people to register and see if that's effective as well.
Have you thought at all about whether other interventions that people are doing, like there's people doing texting of their friends to try to get them to vote or other relational things? Seems like there's some evidence that hearing from a friend, in your case, people are not writing friends, right? They're writing people that you select.
They're writing strangers. That's right.
I think there's evidence that a note or a text from a friend is significantly more powerful. But I wonder if you might consider changing your model a little bit like that or testing it, or whether coordinating tests with other people's tests so that you could see if things are additive or not. Things might even be multiplicative.
Yeah, that's a great point. I have thought about that. And actually, I forgot to mention this. I did do a layered experiment in New York on Staten Island, where I had a partner group on the ground called Staten Island Women Who March. And they wrote a ton of letters. And then I also helped them run an experiment to send text messages to a subsample of the people who got letters right before the election. And so we have done one test like that, and it will be interesting to see whether it made a difference.
Are you waiting for your midterm results like most
Yes.
people still? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little frustrating in the turnout game how there's months of like having all that voter file stuff sorted out.
Yeah, it takes a while. It sounds like we can't really expect fully updated data until the end of March. We won't really know until that point. But to your question, yes, I'm definitely interested in the either additive or hopefully even multiplicative effects of different interventions. On the first part of your question about relational, sort of more traditionally, there's nothing traditional because it's all new. But what people usually mean when they talk about sort of relational efforts now, I am interested in that. I've thought a little bit about that. I think it's not totally obvious to me how that would work with this platform because, as you can imagine, the volunteers who are most enthusiastic about writing letters, like anything else, probably 80% of the letters were written by 20% of the volunteers. And most people don't have 1,000 friends in battleground congressional districts that are good targets. So, you know, there's sort of a trade-off. It's like the advantage that we have is that we can really target the people who we think are most important to reach and deploy kind of a national audience of volunteers to write to them.
If you knew who your targets are and then you went and found their friends and told them to...
And prioritized having those letters be written by those people, yeah, maybe. It would definitely be complicated. So I think actually more importantly, a lot of the people who are interested in doing these kinds of things are interested because they live in firmly red or firmly blue districts. Part of the appeal is being able to sort of have an impact in a place where a marginal vote really goes much farther. And often you're not going to have a lot of friends in that district. So I think it's worth considering. I've definitely thought a little bit about it, but it's on the list.
Did you form Vote Forward as a nonprofit? What is it?
Yes, it's a nonprofit. It's a 527 nonprofit, which means that it is, because it's sort of explicitly partisan, it probably could have been a 501c4, couldn't be a 501c3. And as a 527, I kind of did it that way partly because it was easy and quick. The limitation is that we are not allowed to explicitly advocate for the election of candidates by name. So we kind of just don't. We encourage people to vote, but we don't. We ask the letter writers not to mention the name of the candidate. That's a sort of regulatory restriction that we're under, but also I happen to think it's the right choice. So it's kind of by accident that it happened that way. But yes, we're a 527 nonprofit.
Did you raise and spend much money?
Not much. We raised some kind of just enough to fund the project through Act Blue. And in the end, I think we spent a total of about $35,000 to run this thing, mostly on data. If you were to figure out the cost per vote for that investment, I think it would look absurdly low compared to most other.
I have no idea what a vote typically costs for other methods of gaining turnout. I should know, but do you have a sense?
I might be misremembering this, but my impression is that the academic research suggests anywhere from in the $50 to $100 range to perhaps some research would suggest that it's actually impossible to reliably buy a vote, but
to get an extra vote in turnout. This is not...
Sorry, not to buy a vote, to like cause an extra vote to be cast by doing things. My impression is funders generally look at CPVs of hope, look for sort of in the 30s to 50s.
I interviewed not too long ago Amber McReynolds, who ran for the city and county of Denver, the administration of their voting systems. And they made a bunch of changes, including vote by mail that gets tracked and lets you know whether your vote is accepted and things like that, that hugely impacted turnout. And Colorado and that city are very high, as are other places that vote. One of the most fruitful ways to increase turnout is to reduce barriers to voting. When you think about that, does that make you think, "Woo, maybe I should also go after other types of reforms?"
I'm definitely interested personally in those things. So like I'm entirely in favor of everything that makes it easier to vote, automatic voter registration and, you know, same day registration and vote by mail and re-enfranchising formerly incarcerated people. I think all of those things are great and I want them all to happen. I think the advocacy front on voting rights is kind of a different lane from what this tactic can work for. So it's not totally obvious to me that there's synergy there. Although the audience of folks who volunteered are very likely to be also folks who are interested in those kinds of reforms. So it's an interesting idea. I mean, I wonder if there's a way, if nothing else, to sort of point people towards worthy causes on that front that they can also support.
Here, work with this advocacy group, or if you're interested in turnout, or...
Oh, there is one other sense in which I am involved in this, which is that there's two levels of targeting that we do. So one is which elections do we focus on, and the other is which voters do we target. In choosing the elections, one of the criteria is, especially in 2019 and 2020, is going to be states where control of the state legislature is in play and may well have an impact on redistricting and on other voting rights measures. So we do look at that, and that's part of the criteria for where to focus.
Right. And then there's groups like Flippable and Swing Left and the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee and people who are working pretty hard on targeting resources at state legislative campaigns. You may get more bang for your buck by that kind of targeting that is kind of coming out of those sort of organizations.
Yes, quite possibly. That's definitely one of the questions for 2019 is if we were to focus on some crucial, some important state legislative races, what kind of impact would we see? And probably more.
And all you really need to do is partner with these organizations that are already targeting, like go to Flippable and say, hey, point to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what Daily Coast did and some of these other folks. One thing I'm not quite clear on yet is when exactly the primaries are for all these state legislative races later this year. But once we know which races we're going to work on, I'm definitely interested in collaborating with some of these other organizations and working together.
Well, what question should I have asked you that I failed to?
You elicited most of the story of what this thing is and how it came to be and what we're planning to do next. There's a question of how people can help if they want to. We do accept donations on Act Blue and would be very grateful for any support that people can offer. We don't have any campaigns currently active just because it isn't obvious who to write to, but people can still sign up to write letters and sort of get registered and be ready when we do launch our next campaigns on the website.
Well, is there anything about your site itself that bears explaining?
You know, it's a relatively straightforward sign-up process, but it's not immediate. So we were a little bit worried, especially at the beginning, about abuse and making sure that trolls and other malefactors don't cause havoc. And the way we prevented that was by having a sign-up process that requires a little bit of time and attention. So when you first sign up, you'll be asked some questions about your own intentions about voting, and you'll be asked to write a couple sentences about why you're participating. We do actually review what people write before approving them to get started. It's not super relevant right at this moment, but when people start signing up and we have other campaigns going, it's good for people to know that it does take a day or so to get approved. In practice, we saw essentially no abusive behavior of the platform. And I think it's because by introducing some hurdles, and also because it's kind of an analog activity, there are much easier ways for trolls to cause harm. But it is worth mentioning that when people use it, if they see some friction around those kinds of things, that's the reason, is just a measure of caution. The only other thing people really need to know is that it requires a printer. I guess not everybody has a printer, but it is kind of necessary either to have one or to have access to one.
It's a little bit hilarious that handwritten letters require a printer. I guess they could always write their own letter.
they could, but we discouraged it because there's the messaging in the letter that's typed is important and careful. And also because there actually is some there's like a unique code on each one that you can use to unsubscribe and to visit the website and indicate that you received it. And that stuff all needs to be printed. So it is kind of a hybrid of handwritten and pre-printed, and that is important.
Well, Scott, it's been very interesting talking to you today. Anything else you want to say?
It occurred to me just now that I don't know much about you. I guess we don't need to, your listeners certainly do. Maybe you don't need to include this part, but I was going to ask you to tell me more about your project, this podcast. And I'm sort of curious how you got started doing this and what you're interested in at the moment. But other than that, no, I just wanted to, say thanks for doing this and for bringing attention to my project and other folks who are doing good work here. And I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I guess my interest in the space goes back a long way. So the year and a half or so, I guess it's more now, that I've been interviewing three sort of practitioners a week has been really fun, keeping up to date on what's happening and giving me a chance to introduce different people to each other occasionally, or advise, or even more occasionally invest in some activities that are going on. It is really remarkable and encouraging to see the number of smart people who've recently brought their talents into trying to kind of win the fight for Democrats and progressives in a time where we got to turn the country around, obviously. My background before that is I started and for many years ran a political software company called NGP Software, and then NGP Van, which runs a lot of the technology for the Democratic Party and other progressive organizations.
Yeah. Got it.
So I going back all the way into college, I've been interested in the intersection of technology and politics and lots of other things about politics and many other things. So it's fun to talk to someone like you who's bringing a fresh look and a new project into what's going on out there.
Fantastic. I suppose that is one other thing I should mention, is that the software is open source.
A downside to open sourcing a partisan project, though, is can be just picked up by the other side.
Yes, that's true. Although a lot of the complicated stuff around like who's targeted and how is not part of the code base. I kind of do that. It's sort of like the plot, like some of the nuts and bolts of the software are open, and some of the more sensitive stuff is not. But the important point being that I am eager to involve people who are technologists who are interested in working on this kind of thing. So that's another way that folks can help if they're interested. Definitely happy to hear from anybody who wants to write some code and submit some pull requests to this thing. I have a lot of work to do to get it ready for 2019 and 2020.
Great. I hope you find some good volunteers or collaborators for that.
Awesome.
That was Scott Forman at Vote Forward. He's at votefwd.org. I'm interested to see how Scott improves and extends Vote Forward going forward. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.